our work draws heavily on the work of the ILO. If there's one organization in the world that doesn't need a general introduction to the subject of business and human rights, it's the ILO. You've been at this, not you personally, the organization since 1919. And as you mentioned, the tripartite declaration anticipated a great deal of subsequent normative development that people are still drawing on. In fact, in my own mandate on matters of workers' rights, I've simply referred and deferred to the ILO and drawn on the work of the organization and focused our efforts on the broader strategic issues of business relations with communities and societies as a whole, in addition to workers. So let me take a few minutes to outline a little bit of the background of the mandate and where we are today, and then focus in on a couple of elements of the policy framework that we've developed that may be of particular interest to you, one having to do with the notion of human rights due diligence on the part of companies, and the other on grievance mechanisms, which obviously relate very closely to worker management issues. Some of you may recall that this mandate has its origins in a debate that goes back to the 1990s. The issue of business and human rights became a cause of major interest in the 1990s as a result of the wave of outsourcing and offshoring, the fact that the extractive industries began to operate in ever more difficult contexts in which they had little experience in operating, and so on. The then Subcommission on Human Rights developed a draft document called the Norms on Transnational Corporations and Other Business Enterprises for consideration by the Commission on Human Rights. And to simplify a bit, what that effort essentially sought to do was to take the major human rights commitments that states had adopted for themselves and simply impose them on companies as well. Say these are now also corporate responsibilities directly under international law, differentiated from state obligations only by two undefined notions, one primary and secondary responsibility, and the other that the corporate responsibility or legal duty would hold within corporate spheres of influence. That also was not defined, and as you can imagine, both of those concepts are fairly elastic and lend themselves to very different interpretations depending on who is doing the interpreting. It wouldn't come as much of a surprise to you that the business community was not enthusiastic about this effort. The NGOs were, because somehow this promised to become binding on companies under international law. And states were not enthusiastic either, and their response was, look, we're not going to act on this document. In fact, they adopted a resolution that said it has no legal force and no one should act on it, but they were concerned that the issue as a whole shouldn't fall off the table because they believed that it was an important challenge going forward. And so what the Commission on Human Rights did in 2005 was to adopt a resolution asking the Secretary General to appoint a special representative to look at the challenges anew and come back with ideas that could generate greater consensus among all stakeholders in the process. I think the major steps that we took at the beginning, which have served us very well in the mandate, is really twofold. One, we didn't begin with answers. We began with questions and a great deal of empirical research. And the research consisted of numerous studies, including very empirical analyses of where were the major problems, what industry sectors, what regions of the world, how big of a problem is business in human rights? Is it getting bigger? And so on and so forth. Secondly, what are the applicable standards? Everybody had their own story about what international law said, for example. And not surprisingly, their story coincided with their interests, as often happens, or their aspirations, as the case may be. So we did fairly exhaustive analyses of the applicable standards. We looked at voluntary initiatives. Several hundred company-based, industry-based, multi-stakeholder initiatives to examine what works, what doesn't, and why, what lessons can we draw from this. Having done that, we asked the question then, where are the gaps and how do we begin to bridge the gaps? And that's where the policy framework that you have already referred to came in, which we proposed in 2008. As was noted, the framework rests on three pillars, the first being the state duty to protect against human rights abuses by third parties, including business, through appropriate policies, regulation, and adjudication. This is a pillar that is heavily infused with legal obligations on the part of states. And we also provided a number of policy rationales for why states and state entities ought to adopt certain policies, for example, export credit agencies, when they promote an investment in a conflict zone, ought to require a heightened level of due diligence than if the investment goes into Denmark, for example. So that's the state duty to protect. Secondly, the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, which, as was noted, means to act with due diligence to avoid infringing on the rights of others and to address adverse impacts that may occur. And then third and finally, greater access by victims to effective remedy, both judicial and non-judicial. So it's a comprehensive framework in that it involves the major players, as it were. It clearly differentiates the roles of states and the roles of businesses. We don't believe that business should take on the roles of government. We believe governments should do what governments are intended to do, which is to govern and to govern in the public interest. Business is here to do business. But in the process of doing business, business ought not to infringe on the rights of others. That's the fundamental point that we are making. And both states and companies can contribute to effective remedy by providing both non-judicial, in the case of business, certainly, and also judicial avenues of redress. So having stressed the sort of comprehensive nature of the framework, let me focus in on a couple of points which, as I say, may be a particular interest to you. First is the notion of human rights due diligence, which we have elaborated discussed extensively with the business community with corporate lawyers and with others to make sure that we get it right. And it's an answer to the question, how does a company avoid infringing on the rights of others? How does a company know that it respects human rights? It's okay for companies to say they respect human rights, but how do they know? How do they demonstrate to themselves and to others that they do? Well, the answer that we've provided, the appropriate response to managing the risk of infringing on the rights of others, is to exercise adequate due diligence. In my current report, we actually have a bumper sticker line, of which I'm very proud. It says, human rights due diligence is a potential game changer for companies. They can move the game from naming and shaming to knowing and showing. In other words, rather than reacting to external criticism, and companies can develop their own internal systems to know what impacts they are having that may infringe on the rights of others, and then demonstrate that that they are addressing those challenges. Now, the notion of due diligence is something that companies are familiar with. Starting in the 1990s, companies began to develop fairly sophisticated due diligence internal controls for ongoing management of risks in a variety of areas, for example, to prevent employment discrimination, to comply with environmental commitments, and to prevent criminal misconduct on the part of company officers or other employees. So the notion of due diligence has evolved from a simple transactional understanding, that's something you do before you buy another company, for example, to manage risk more generally, drawing on those features of due diligence systems and combining them with what's unique to human rights, we have, as I say, proposed this notion for companies. One size does not fit all. It's something that I'm acutely aware of. We live in a world of 80,000 transnational corporations, 10 times as many subsidiaries, and millions of SMEs. And it makes no sense to expect an SME to follow the same due diligence procedures as a company that has 200,000 employees and operates in 200 countries in the world. So what we're saying there is that the principles ought to be universally applicable, right? But the methodologies and the tools that are employed obviously will differ depending on circumstances and the size of the company and even to some extent the industry sector. So considered in that spirit, the components, if you will, of a due diligence process consist of four elements. One, a statement of policy or commitment or principles or whatever the company calls them to respect human rights. Secondly, periodic assessments of the actual and potential human rights impact of company activities and relationships with third parties, security forces, if you're operating in a difficult environment, for example. Thirdly, the integration of these commitments and assessments into company internal oversight and control systems. And fourthly, tracking and reporting performance. As I say, the scale of this process for a small and medium-sized enterprise, it'll be as much cognitive as it will be institutional because of the nature or the size of the enterprise itself. So that's the notion of human rights due diligence. Let me talk briefly about grievance mechanisms. In the ideal world, we would have state-based judicial and non-judicial mechanisms that form the foundation of remedy for corporate-related human rights challenges. Company grievance mechanisms, company-level grievance mechanisms, however, can serve two very important functions quite apart from that. One, company-level grievance mechanisms can provide a feedback loop and a monitoring system that the company employs, which gets information directly from those it impacts, enabling them to raise concerns early before they escalate. One of the things that we discovered in our research is that human rights allegations against companies for major human rights violations, it turns out, emerge not as major human rights violations. They emerge as minor grievances that are ignored. Somebody runs over somebody's cattle, and there's no place to go to complain. So a community gets organized, and they start demonstrating outside the company installation. They close down the only access road to a mine. The police is called out, or the armed forces may be called out. Shots are fired. Somebody gets killed, and all of a sudden you've got a huge human rights problem on your hands that began with somebody running over the cattle. Now, this is a hypothetical example. No, it's not. It actually has happened. We know of cases where it's happened, but I'm using this as an illustration of how early recourse to dealing with grievances at the local level as they emerge can be enormously helpful for the community in which companies operate and also the company itself. Now, in the grievance mechanism notion relates obviously very closely to the role of unions, and so I wanted to mention that in particular. In the realm of workers' rights, the ideal scenario is that there be genuine freedom of association, legitimate and trusted unions, and good union management processes that are available to handle individual and collective workers' grievances. But we also know that this is far from being the reality in many places. And so while the full implementation of workers' rights remains our objective, in the interim, such grievance mechanisms as we are promoting, in fact, can put the lack of worker management mechanisms on the table in the first place, and helps advance workers' causes as well. The mandate has run a fairly extensive consultation process on what makes for effective grievance mechanisms. And we are road testing, we're piloting these notions with five companies on five continents in an attempt to learn from these pilots before we then make our final proposals next year. As I say, fundamental to our approach has been that grievance mechanisms, when they are not themselves union management processes, mustn't undermine legitimate trade unions and effective social dialogue mechanisms. Now, in the most recent report, we've also referred to the global framework agreements as a useful contribution to dealing with issues related to workers' rights, and there are valuable lessons to be learned from that experience, which we hope to draw on as well. So of the many things I could have discussed, I pulled out these two because I think they may relate well to your own interests and concerns, the notion of human rights due diligence and company-level grievance mechanisms. So let me just bring these remarks to a close, and I look forward to engaging in discussion. I noted at the outset that I look to the ILO for guidance on labor rights issues. One area where further guidance would be helpful is what has come to be known as precarious work. The growth in contract-based work or casualization or whatever your favorite expression of it may be, and its possible implications for workers' rights. This subject has been raised in several of my stakeholder consultations, as well as in written submissions to my mandate by workers' organizations. I am not an expert in this area, but you are, and I look forward to getting guidance from the ILO on this subject. So, in conclusion, let me just say that I'm very pleased that the Protect, Respect, and Remedy framework has been so well received by all stakeholders. We've just come through another Human Rights Council meeting. 25 delegations spoke. They were all extremely supportive. The expectation, which was not part of the original mandate, but it was expressed by these delegations, is that we should present a set of guiding principles for consideration by the Human Rights Council after extensive consultations with all stakeholders, including business, workers, civil society, and of course with governments themselves. There is no single silver bullet solution to business and human rights challenges. It's an extremely complex area. As the current economic crisis has underscored starkly, all social actors have to learn to do many things differently from the way in which we've done them in the past if we are going to succeed. But those things must cohere, and they must generate cumulative progress in the business and human rights domain in our own small way. That's what we hope the Protect, Respect, and Remedy framework will help achieve.